Michael Parenti is an internationally known author, scholar, speaker, and activist whose eye-opening critiques of the political economy and political culture are largely shut out from the mainstream media. Tens of thousands of people have had to find out about him in circuitous ways because his analysis and ideological perspective is feared by the powers that be, feared by a system that owns and controls so much of this society and keeps a larger public from hearing his words. Despite these obstacles, for more than 35 years on his own efforts, through writing and speaking, Michael has been reaching enthusiastic and appreciative audiences. He offers insights into a wide range of subjects, including such topics as the hypocrisies of the U.S. foreign policy, the manipulation of the mass media, the nature of fascism, the struggles around communism and revolution, the political economy of racism and sexism, and the contradictions between capitalism and democracy. In his struggle against the dominant political ideology, which is our struggle too, he has written over 250 articles and 13 books, all noted for being well-written and engaging. Among his most recent books are Against Empire, Dirty Truths, Black Shirts and Reds, Rational Fascism and the Overthrow of Communism, and his most recent book, America Besieged. Now, let's join Michael for a trip back to ancient Rome, where he'll demonstrate how the past and the present can inform each other. It is with great pride and pleasure that I present to you my friend, Michael Parenti.
Thank you. That was so nice. Sometimes it gets embarrassing when the applause are longer before the talk than after. And contrary to the rumor that was going around, I had no intention of giving this talk wearing a toga. That was not a serious. So some of you came under a false impression. Tonight I want to go back 2,000 years to talk about social realities that remain relevant to us. Our images of the past are created largely by history's winners. The losers are muffled or muted, while their voices are very rarely heard. I think I agree with Catherine Morland, who said, "It's rather odd that history should be so dull, since so much of it must be invention." The writing of history has long been a privileged calling. It's undertaken in the church, the royal court, the affluent townhouse, the government agency, the university, the corporate-funded foundation. The powers that be not only try to control events, they also try to control our understanding of these events, which is part of controlling the events themselves. Class struggle extends into the writing of history itself. Edward Gibbon, author of the monumental work, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, he talked about how history had to be written by gentlemen, because only gentlemen had the means to pursue such a calling. In his words, "Wretched will be the work of those whose daily scholarly efforts are stimulated by daily hunger." Gibbon himself produced what I would call gentleman's history, a genre heavily imbued with an upper-class ideological perspective. From the very beginning, all through antiquity, we had gentlemen historians. Homer, Herodotus, Thucydides, Polybius, Cicero, Livy, Plutarch, Suetonius, Appian, Josephus, Tacitus. I'm naming the ones I've read. I've left out a few. But almost all of whom had a rather low opinion of the common people. Gibbon himself was a member of Parliament, a firm supporter of British imperialism. He opposed extending rights to the American colonialists. He hated the egalitarian of the French Revolution. This Gibbon had no difficulty conjuring up a fairy tale pastoral image of the Roman Empire. In his words, "Where all the vanquished nations blended into one great people, with no desire to regain their independence, enjoying the benefits of Rome's rule, directed by both absolute power, virtue, and wisdom." Yeah, right. Rarely do we hear about an empire built upon sacked towns, burned crops, shattered armies, enslaved prisoners, and mercilessly impoverished and overtaxed populations. One eminent 20th century British historian, Cyril Robinson, offers a familiar and fanciful notion of an empire that's achieved stochastically, that is, by chance, without conscious design, without intent. Quote, "It was perhaps almost as true of Rome as of Great Britain that she acquired her world dominion in a fit of absence of mind." Yeah, right again. Another fairy tale image, an imperialism without imperialists. Isn't that remarkable? Well, what do you have, a conspiracy theory? Do you think they consciously planned and calculated and raised armies and decided there were profitable areas to conquer? Do you think they actually thought about it ahead of time? It was all spontaneous, confused, innocent, absent-minded. This is not so funny. We hear the same thing today. The United States was thrusted into the world arena and had to reluctantly assume the role of world leader to meet the challenges of the 20th century. We're never told who did the thrusting, for whose interests, and at what cost to people at home and abroad, nor why it still remains such a global imperative to have world leadership now, even without the bugaboo of world communist conspiracy to use as an excuse. Along with this class bias, the gentleman historian is likely to be a male supremacist. Was anybody surprised by that? Gibbon, for instance, describes one emperor's wife as, quote, "united to a lively imagination, a firmness of mind, and strength of judgment seldom bestowed on her sex." I love Berkeley audiences. You know, some colleges, you read the quote like that, and you sit and you go, "So what's wrong with that?" But let's not get discouraged. Okay. Usually left unnoticed was the plight of ordinary Roman women, who tended to die younger than their male counterparts because of childbirth, exhaustion, malnutrition, and mistreatment. In recent decades, by the way, with the emergence of feminist scholarship on ancient Rome, the treatment of Roman women has improved. I mean, the scholarly treatment of the scholarly treatment of this subject has improved. God, I hate Berkeley audiences. Some gentlemen historians let slip a noticeable ethnic bigotry or ethno-class bigotry. Cyril Robinson asserts that the, quote, "purity of Roman blood began to be contaminated by proletarians of Greek and Oriental origin, persons of feeble and incapable character," "unable to assimilate the national habits of decency and restraint. Although not all Greeks, of course, were vicious or unwholesome characters." It's always a kind of bitterly amusing when bigots try to smuggle in their bigotry under a kind of balanced statement, you know. "Some of my best friends are feeble and incapable characters."
True.
The great Theodore Mommsen. Mommsen. Maybe you remember the Mark Twain's description of Mommsen, the popular reception he got at a German university when Twain was visiting Germany. And from whom we might expect something better. Mommsen scornfully describes the Roman Forum. Now, the Roman Forum was that great open area where the assembly met, the popular assembly, the common people. Mommsen calls it a shouting fest for everyone in the shape of a man. Egyptians and Jews, street boys and slaves, freedmen and Greeks. By the way, Mommsen was never all that liberal or all that left. He became more liberal in his old age when he entered Parliament. Anyway, when push comes to shove, most left academics are more academic than left. Another eminent classicist, Jerome Carcopino, writes that interbreeding between Roman aristocrats and their female slaves or freedwomen created a hybridization similar to that which has more recently contaminated other slave-owning peoples. Whoa. It strongly accentuated the national and social decomposition of Rome, unquote. I mean, no Nazi blood theorist could have said it better. I mean, these are reputable historians I'm quoting from today. The progenitor of all gentlemen historians of the late Republic and one of its major participants was Cicero, who has been worshipped by professors and Latin teachers throughout the ages. Cicero railed against the Greeks and Jews who rallied to the side of democratic leaders. Quote, impoverished individuals. See, that's a pejorative term. They're impoverished, so what could they be worth? Right there you see his class bigotry. Impoverished individuals, they often throw our assemblies into confusion. The Greeks are given to shameless lying, the Jews to barbaric superstition. You know how influential these Greeks and Jews can be in informal assemblies, unquote. That's the great Cicero. Tonight I want to concentrate on that period of ancient Rome known as the Late Republic, specifically the period from 133 BC to 44 BC, the year that Caesar was assassinated. While a republican form, how democratic was the Roman Republic in actual content? At the very bottom of the social order was a large slave population, about one-third of the entire populace, many of whom were worked to death in the mines and on the plantations, or latifundia, as the Roman called them. That's the Roman word, latifundia. On the next rung was a great mass of urbanized free Romans. They were known, the Latin word was proletariat. Many of them ex-slaves or the descendants of slaves who lived at the barest subsistence level. Many of them lived crowded in thousands of disease-ridden tenements within Rome itself, cheaply built structures that went up 8 and 9 stories high, that frequently burned down or collapsed and killed their occupants. The rents charged for these fire traps were usually more than the poor could afford, forcing them to double and triple up under highly unsanitary conditions. No running water, no sewage disposal, inadequate ventilation, and lots of typhoid. A rung above the proletariats were the small farmers around the outskirts of the city and beyond, a substantial part of the Italian population. And above that, a very small middle class of minor officials, merchants, and light industry employers. Looming over this multitude was a few thousand multimillionaires, the class known as equestrians. They were sort of a lesser nobility. They were called equestrians, or equites in Latin, because they were rich enough to be in the cavalry, which was the elite thing. They could afford the cavalry, although by the late Republic, most of them had never even been on a horse. The equestrians, most of them were state contractors, bankers, traders, tax collectors, and landowners. Now, at the very apex of this social pyramid were the wealthy landed aristocrats who populated the Roman Senate, who also invested in business and banking, along with their vast holdings. The Senate aristocrats were absentee owners of vast latifundia. They did very little for the land except populate it with slave labor and squeeze it for all the profits they could get out of it. Cicero, who was an equestrian and a member of the Senate, owned more than 8 villas. He had many speculative investments. and he had numerous inner-city tenements. And it's very interesting that very few present-day historians of ancient Rome mention the fact that Cicero was a slumlord. He actually bragged about how profitable his tenements were. They didn't think it was very important for us to know that about Cicero. The wealthy grew still richer by the second century by usurping the ager publicus, or the arger publicus. Our pronunciations of Latin, by the way, is heavily compromised by English. I could probably satisfy some Latin purists here if I talked about Cicero instead of Cicero and Julius Caesar instead of Julius Caesar, but I think the rest of you would get irritated. The ager publicus was the public lands, fertile state-owned lands outside of Rome, beautiful lands, very fertile, that had been farmed for generations by small farming collectives, which paid a modest rent to the state, and which produced enough food to feed the entire city. During times of war from the 3rd century on down to the 2nd, with farmers away in the army, the farms couldn't be kept up, and the aristocrats started buying them up at bargain prices. Or the aristocrats increasingly used hired thugs to force the families off the public land, replacing them with slave labor. I think a process that was completed probably early in the 2nd century by 190, 180 BC. And eventually the aristocrats stopped paying rent. So there was a total privatization of the ager publicus became the ager privatus. That's a word I just made up. We're seeing that same thing happening all over the world. So greater accumulation for the few brought increasing economic misery to the many. This process of egalitarian displacement continues to this day in many parts of the world, including the United States itself. I was talking to members of the Farmers Union in Nebraska, and they will tell you stories about what family farms are facing and what a cost this is to our whole agrarian culture. It reinforces, I think, the thesis I presented in Dirty Truth that great wealth creates great poverty. We often think of the disparities between wealth and poverty as just being a matter of maldistribution. And in fact, it is an interracial dynamic. You cannot have rich without poor. You cannot have masters, rich masters, without poor slaves creating that wealth. You cannot have lords without serfs. You cannot have rich plutocrats without hardworking, exploited workers and overtaxed taxpayers. Rome, as I said, was a republic more in form than content. But neither was the form all that democratic. Almost all major decisions were made by the Senate, an aristocratic, non-elective oligarchy. Numbering about 600 men of wealth, the Senate controlled foreign policy, the purse strings of the republic, the appointment of military commanders. Besides the Senate, there were two assemblies in which there were many more voting units allocated to the rich, which permitted the wealthy class to prevail on most issues. So even the assemblies were not really accessible to the common people or democratic. Those attending the assemblies could vote only on proposals submitted by one of the higher magistrates. And they could only vote yea or nay, and that was it. There was no right to amend any clause. It was called fast track. With enough unity and mass mobilization, occasionally popular forces could carry something through the Senate, and I will discuss those instances, but that was the rare exception. Our friend Cyril Robinson finds nothing wrong with senatorial domination. He writes, "Those who bore the chief burden of fighting and financing the city's wars should also possess the chief voice in directing the city's course." First of all, he doesn't explain why financing wars should give you civic power, civic monopoly power. In any case, the very rich did not bear the chief burden of fighting. That dangerous task fell mostly to the yeomen, the peasants, and later on, to a lesser degree, the proletariat. In fact, the rich senators carried very little of the financial burden. They paid no taxes. They lent money to the state that was paid back to them with interest, paid back from taxes that were levied upon the common people at home and in the provinces, the conquered provinces. So you had this combination of deficit spending and regressive taxes that amounted to an upward redistribution of income from poor taxpayers to rich creditors. Does that sound familiar at all? To run for election, one had to be either wealthy or have the support of wealthy backers. The buying of votes was widespread. Rarely did candidates address important issues. To distinguish themselves from each other, they emphasized their personal qualities, their integrity and leadership, the prestige of their family name, their association with important personalities of the day, their record of public service and military service. Does any of that sound familiar? The only thing missing was television, I'd say. Within the Senate itself, control was concentrated in an inner circle of 20 or so of the most influential aristocratic families. By the second century, this elite group, the richest, the most prestigious, most influential, had themselves divided into two factions. The larger one was called the Optimates, literally the best men, as they modestly referred to themselves. They were conservatives devoted to expanding the privileges and powers of the rich. The smaller faction of Senate elites were called populares. They were reformers with democratic tendencies who sometimes sided with the common people and with the sovereign right of the assembly to make decisions without prior consent from the Senate. Modern-day historians are perfectly aware that the Senate enjoyed a near monopoly of undemocratic power. Yet they are filled with praise for these oligarchs, describing them, I'll give you a few quotes, as bred to a strong tradition of cautious sanity and self-restraint. Gentlemen of responsibility and leadership, stout-hearted, level-headed, and patriotic. Historians look kindly upon this republic for the few. For them, senatorial plutocracy is more acceptable and less threatening than proletarian egalitarianism. They embrace Cicero, a self-enriching slaveholder, slumlord, and ruling class mouthpiece. They embrace Cicero as a champion of republican liberty, who opposed Julius Caesar and who refused to live under tyranny. And when I say they, I mean about 95% of present-day historians of Rome are Cicero admirers. Only a handful are sympathetic to the populares and Democrats. What does that say about our universities? Cicero, that great champion of republican liberty, deplored such things as the secret ballot. He said the secret ballot makes it easier for the common people to act independently and do mischief. A year after Caesar was murdered in 44, Cicero was not among the assassins, but he fully supported the deed. He wrote to Brutus and other associates, calling for a ruthless bloodletting, a final solution against the Democrats. I do not admit any doctrine of mercy. There should be a salutary severity, for if we are going to be merciful, civil wars will never cease. We need extreme measures, unquote. One is reminded, by the way, of Cicero's own role as consul 20 years earlier in 63. Now remember, this is BC, we go backwards. 63 comes 20 years ahead of 44. They were very confused in those days. Cicero in 63 launched a witch hunting campaign against reformers in the Senate and then ordered without trial the unlawful execution of five people he charged with conspiracy against the state. A couple of them were senators, too, on the basis of very dubious and trumped-up evidence. It's called the Catiline Conspiracy. Few modern-day historians pass severe judgment on this political crime. H.H. Scholard, he sets the tone by allowing that, well, Cicero may have been, quote, over-hasty, but he had good reason to feel he had done his duty. Indeed, he had saved his country, unquote. And I'm saying, again, behind this willingness to repress popular forces. Behind this willingness of modern-day historians to accept this repression of popular forces is a chronic fear of the democratic excesses of the people. I'm not talking about Cicero. We can understand this guy was, you know, involved in the events of the day. He was a rich class elitist, and that was that. I'm talking about Professor Scullard and other historians like him, who live in this supposedly democratic age, but who suffer from the fear of the people mobilizing and agitating without the restraints imposed by upper-class men of moderation and probity. Upper-class moderation and probity, my friends, exists more in the minds of gentlemen historians than it does in actual history. And these guys say nothing about who is to restrain those at the top with the power.